The same nothing came back at me, just like the other few times I had seen her. "Sorry," I said. Then I added, "I wish I did."
"I'm Tracy. Tracy Brown. We were together at Miss Agnes."
The Miss Agnes Home for Girls was one of the group homes where I had spent time. It had been a stopping-off point for a few months when I was maybe 14 or 15.
"You used to help me with my math homework," Officer Brown continued. "You remember that? I was terrible with fractions. No one had ever really taught them to me right. You were the first one to make me cut out a whole circle and say that was 1/1. And then you had me cut it in half and say one piece of it was 1/2. Everything made sense after that."
"I know it was a long time ago."
A dim memory of a chubby black girl with cornrows came into my head, freed from whatever deep cranial fold it had been hiding in. "Oh, right. Tracy Brown," I said, the recollection growing a bit stronger. "You used to eat cornflakes for dinner. We couldn't get you to even try anything else."
"Yeah, and wouldn't you know, I can't even look at a box of cornflakes now," she said with a little chortle.
"I have that same thing with SpaghettiOs," I said. "I had this one foster mom that fed them to us, no lie, 6 days a week. I get chills when I even pass them in a grocery store."
She laughed again. It was nice to feel human for the first time in weeks. Then the smile went away.
"You also told me one time that I had to keep the most important part of myself locked away in here," she said, tapping her heart. "And to make sure I never let anyone get at that. And to remember it was good, no matter what. You told me that's how you survived. And that really helped me get through some tough times."
I nodded.
"That's pretty good advice for in here, too," she said quietly.
"Yeah," I said, looking down at the concrete under my feet. She still hadn't closed or locked the cage. I wanted to ask her 1,000 questions. About how long she stayed at Miss Agnes. About whether she had been adopted. About how she had survived and, apparently, thrived well enough to land a good job like this one. But she beat me to the next thought.
"I hope you don't mind, but I've been keeping track of your case ever since you first came in here. I have a cousin who works in the sheriff's office. Have you talked to your lawyer lately?"
"No, why?"
"Well, I don't know if this will help you, but a man came in and tried to confess to killing that guy in the cemetery."
For a very brief moment, hope surged in me until I ran through the sentence in my head again.
"What do you mean, tried to?" I asked.
"It turned out he was lying. He said he shot the guy. But the guy in the cemetery wasn't shot."
Who would do something like that?"
"My cousin said the guy's name was Curran. Something or other Curran."
I slumped against one of the poles that supported the cage, then slid down it until I was sitting in a small ball with my legs pulled up against my chest.
"You know him?" she asked.
"He's my biological father. Estranged, obviously."
Tracy brought her hand to her mouth. I didn't need to fill in any more blanks for a fellow Miss Agnes alumna.
"Oh, wow," she said,
which nicely summarized my immediate thoughts on the matter.
"Well," she said apologetically, "I have to close this now."
"I understand." And then, to make sure she knew I was absolving her totally, I smiled.
And I meant it.
I stayed in my little ball on the concrete for a while after she left. Then, eventually, I stood and looked up at the atmosphere, into the high reaches where the air was thin and the clouds wispy. Somewhere underneath that same sky was my father. And for perhaps the first time in my whole life, I felt myself wishing I could talk to him. In some ways, this was a fitting continuation to our entire relationship, because I never had understood the man. As a little girl, I was constantly confused as to why he was so angry all the time. What had I done to displease him? Was I not a good enough little girl? If I cleaned my room or did a better job brushing my teeth, would he finally start loving me? Now he was even more of an enigma to me. The Billy Curran I had known, the wife-beater and child abuser who thought nothing of fondling his stepdaughter, was a total stranger to altruism. He was, in fact, the living embodiment of the opposite of it. Was there some angle to this I wasn't seeing? Was he getting something out of this? But for however much I flipped it around in my mind, I couldn't see how he could turn this into an advantage for himself. He had tried to take my place in prison, perhaps even on death row. He had failed, yes, but it was the epitome of an unselfish act. Especially from a man who knew exactly what he was getting into. Some people, those who have never been incarcerated, have this deluded belief prison is not all that bad. 3 hots and a cot for free. All this time to do whatever you want. Nonsense like that. My father would have had no such illusions. He had spent 5 years being subjected to its horrors, serving time as a convicted child sex offender, the lowest of the low in the prison pecking order. He knew what it meant to suffer the loss of one's liberty. And he was willing to go back, to take all of it on. For me. Had he really changed? Had prison and sobriety and Jesus and 20 years of reflecting on all his mistakes turned him into something other than the abomination I had known as a girl? Maybe my mother was right. Maybe there always had been something good in him. And maybe, just maybe, and this was quite a thing to consider after 29 years of having every reason to doubt it. He loved me after all.
Chapter 51. The call came just before lunchtime on Friday. Not that Amy Kay was planning to take lunch that day. She was still only midway through all she needed to get done by the end of the week, a list that was particularly pressing, given that Monday would be consumed by the Melanie Barrick drug trial. Amy frowned at the caller ID. If it was Aaron Dansby, calling from his back porch, having already started his weekend, she was going to let it slip through to voicemail. Then she recognized the main number for the state lab in Roanoke and quickly grabbed at the phone. Amy Kay.
Jack Burleson, came the response.
Hearing his name brought back the lingering embarrassment she still felt about Warren Plotz. She was glad the man couldn't see the slight flush in her face. Hello, she said.
Thought you'd appreciate an update on Richard Codery, he said. We're not ready with our full report yet, but there are a couple things we can tell you right now. Got a minute?
Absolutely, thank you, Amy said, pulling out the legal pad where she was keeping her notes on that case.
The first part won't surprise you. Codery was lit up on cocaine when he was killed. There was enough of it in his blood to make an elephant high.
Not surprising. What's the second part?
Well, that's the real reason I'm calling. I read in the paper your sheriff arrested a woman for this crime, right?
Yes, Melanie Barrick.
Well, I don't know who your perpetrator is, but it's sure not a woman.
What do you mean?
The victim's right forefinger had a fair amount of someone else's skin cells under it. The medical examiner concluded Coterie had scratched the perpetrator. We got a nice sample of it. Being a murder case, we prioritized it. So one of our guys just started testing it today. He told me it clearly belonged to a man.
Are you sure?
That Y chromosome is pretty hard to miss.
Got it. So if it's not Melanie Barrick, who is it?
Haven't gotten that far,
Burleson said.
We probably won't be able to run it through for matches for another week or two. But if you have a woman in jail for this, you might want to consider a different theory of the crime.
Like murder for hire, Amy said.
Like that,
Burleson said.
But that's your department, not mine. I just do the science.
They soon ended the call. As she settled the phone back into the cradle, Amy let out a long breath. Murder for hire was a trickier thing to prosecute. The first component was proving some kind of consideration had been exchanged, most likely monetary, though a drug dealer could also pay in product. Amy hadn't yet bothered prying into Melanie Barrick's financial situation. All she knew was that the sheriff's office had seized nearly $4,000 in cash during its raid. There had to be more. It was just a question of where Barrick kept it. The sheriff's office was generally pretty thorough when it executed a warrant, so Amy didn't think Barrick had more cash lying around. But a bank was always a possibility. A clever dealer could easily find ways to make ill-gotten gains look legitimate. Amy looked down at the list of to-dos she had been steadily working through. She already knew she wasn't going to get it done before the weekend after all. In the cop shows, someone barks out, "Pull her financials," and within minutes, a detective has a full list of every banking transaction the defendant has made since childhood, including the large cash withdrawal the day before the crime in question was committed. Reality wasn't quite as easy. Amy could issue a subpoena that would give her access to Melanie Barrick's banking records, yes, but first, Amy had to figure out where Melanie Barrick banked. And she couldn't just subpoena every bank in the area and hope to get lucky. That would be considered phishing, and judges didn't like it. She had to know for sure where Barrick had accounts. There were two ways to go about that. Subpoenaing the IRS would allow Amy to see if Barrick reported interest income from any financial institutions in her most recent tax return. It would also take a minimum of 10 weeks to get a result. Or, Amy was soon lifting herself from behind her desk and moving toward the parking lot. Desper Hollow Road was less than 10 minutes away. She didn't even need to look up the address. Before long, Amy was driving under the railroad tracks, past a trailer belonging to a Confederate history enthusiast, and to the driveway for 104 Desper Hollow Road. The best-case scenario would have been a nice, full garbage can, brimming with discarded bank and credit card statements that had been put out on the curb. Courts had ruled that defendants had no reasonable expectation of privacy when it came to their garbage, which was considered abandoned property. And if it was on the curb, that meant Amy wouldn't be trespassing when she accessed it. She'd be completely in the clear. Except, of course, Melanie Barrick had been in jail for the past 2 weeks, so Amy didn't think she'd find any garbage. There was, however, the second best-case scenario. A mailbox. Tampering with a person's mail was a federal crime. Likewise, removing the contents of a defendant's mailbox was a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. But if the mailbox happened to be open, well, accidents happen. And if Amy happened to be walking by on a public street and be able to see a bank statement lying there in plain sight, well, that would just make her observant. Amy stopped the car and got out. With her toes still firmly planted on Augusta County-owned Desper Hollow Road, she pulled a pen out of her pocket, inserted it into the hooked handle for the mailbox, and pulled. "Oops," she said as the lid opened. She peered inside. The box was stuffed almost to the top. Again using the pen, so if it came up, she could truthfully testify she had touched nothing. She started sifting through the pile. A lot of it was junk, or bills. But about midway through, she came across a half-letter size envelope from Shenandoah Community Credit Union, addressed to Melanie A. Barrick. Amy recognized a monthly statement when she saw one. She kept going, all the way to the bottom of the pile. But that was it. It was entirely possible there were other accounts, of course, a bank that didn't mail monthly statements, or an account whose statements had yet to mail out this month. But this was a start. Amy drove back to the office and was soon typing up a subpoena duces tecum to Shenandoah Community Credit Union, whose corporate offices were in Stanton, and whose in-house counsel Amy knew. By 2 o'clock, she was hitting send on the email. At precisely 3:17, her phone rang. It was the Shenandoah Community Credit Union lawyer, ribbing Amy about dumping this on him on a Friday afternoon. By 4:36, Amy was looking at 4 months' worth of bank statements for the account belonging to Melanie A. Barrick. There was currently $733.28 in her account. The last transaction was a deposit for $278.17 the previous Thursday from Hokie Associates. Amy Googled the name. It was the local Waffle House franchisee. Waffle House? The Shenandoah Valley's most notorious cocaine dealer had been working at Waffle House? That was a twist. There were no substantial withdrawals or transfers. The largest deposits were a series of weekly additions from Diamond Trucking, Inc., but those were below $600, and they had stopped in early March. The largest withdrawals were the monthly mortgage payment and a weekly check for $250 to an Ida Ferncliffe, but that also stopped a month ago. Childcare, Amy could guess. Otherwise, electric company, phone company, insurance company, the usual suspects in what appeared to be a paycheck-to-paycheck existence. Barrick used her debit card to buy groceries, but from the amounts, it didn't seem like she had been eating much lately. The largest cash withdrawal was $20 from a local ATM. If Barrick was leading the life of a freewheeling, free-spending drug kingpin, she wasn't doing it through this bank account. Based on the evidence here, she was somewhere between living frugally and flat broke. There was obviously more to Melanie Barrick than Amy had yet discovered. She'd just have to keep looking. Chapter 52. I couldn't say the previous week had flown by, because time in ADSEG drags along in the most tedious way possible. Mr. Honeywell had gone disturbingly quiet, not visiting or calling. He had sent one note, saying preparations for the trial were going well, and that he had been in touch with Ben. About what, it didn't say. I couldn't think of what Ben could do to help my cause, especially from New Jersey, or wherever he was now. The note ended with instructions to keep my spirits up. Right, because that was so easy. With nothing better to do than play and replay past events, I thought back to my last interaction with Mr. Honeywell. The way he had looked at me in the sheriff's office was different. Like I was now a lost cause. Like I was no longer the innocent he thought I was. Like I was back among that population of clients whose fate didn't cause him to lose sleep at night. And there wasn't much I could do about it. I couldn't even write back to tell him that, for the sake of my mental health, I could really use a fuller update on my defense. I didn't have a stamp. Again, no commissary. The guards weren't allowed to loan me one either. It was against jail policy for guards to give inmates gifts of any kind. Sunday, April 8th, the day before my trial, was like most others, except that it rained. Late in the afternoon, a guard asked me if I still wanted to exploit my constitutional rights by going outside. I surprised him by saying yes. We went through the whole routine with the cuffs and the cage. Once I was locked inside, I was uncuffed and left free. Funny word, that. Free. To explore my 15x15 confinement. The rain was warm, the kind that nourished crops and flowers and life, and it came down steadily. Not quite a torrent, but close. The water pooled on top of the concrete, forming puddles that danced with every drop that fell on them. Within a few minutes, I was drenched. It wasn't all that uncomfortable, once there was no more dry on me to get wet. If anything, the rain felt glorious. My primary reason for going outside was that I wanted to sleep well that night. Fresh air, I thought, would help. So would exercise. I started by running little laps around my cage, then ripped off a set of push-ups. I was strong. Powerful, even. Now 5 pounds below my regular weight, my ribs were tight against my skin. When I moved, there was less of me for my muscles to push around. I could do anything. I leapt onto the chain-link fence, almost like I was flying. Then I dropped back to the ground. My feet hit with a satisfying splash. I did some planks, just because I could. Then some squats. Same reason. It was strangely exhilarating, working myself this way. Maybe because it reminded me that my body, which was denied to me in so many ways while I was incarcerated, was still mine. The air was pungent, earthy and alive despite all the concrete around me. The rain began falling harder. I increased my exertion accordingly, springing with manic ferocity from one movement to the next, sprinting and lunging and hurtling myself all over until my chest actually ached from sucking in so much oxygen. But that was what I wanted, of course. To feel alive. When I was done, when I had pushed myself beyond exhaustion, I lay in the middle of the cage, spread eagle, and let the rain pound me while I thought about Alex. I didn't go with one of my usual memories of him from the past. For the first time since this ordeal began, I permitted myself to think of the future. I visualized, of all places, Shenandoah Valley Social Services, and the day when Alex would be returned to me. I thought of the family services specialist, Tina Anderson, lowering my baby into my arms. I thought of his joy, of my relief, of seeing those beautiful eyes and the bright smile that beamed out from under them. It was dangerous, thinking this way. I clung to it all the same. Chapter 53. Rain always made for a tough day. Rain meant she couldn't take the baby outside. Rain meant being cooped up in the house, trying to come up with new ways to entertain the child. And that wasn't as easy as it used to be. When they first got the baby, he didn't stay awake for more than an hour or two at a time. He was in that phase the books referred to as the fourth trimester, where he acted like he was still in the womb. When he wasn't eating or pooping, he was sleeping. Not so anymore. The naps were fewer and further between. The child was waking up, wanting to explore the world. The woman was fine with that. During the day, anyway. She had gotten a baby Bumbo,
a marvelous foamy little chair that allowed him to sit up, a Johnny jump-up, which attached to a door frame and let him work his little legs, an exercise mat with little animals dangling from a padded bar that looped overhead. He generally didn't last more than about 15 minutes with each activity, but she could keep him busy, because she had the energy to move him from thing to thing. Not so at night. By then, she was just done. Because unlike a biological mother, who had all sorts of hormones coursing through her body, preparing her for just this purpose, her body had nothing extra in it. Just fatigue. It didn't seem to matter to the baby. There were times at night, especially when he hadn't been able to go outside during the day, when he woke up for a feeding, and then was just awake. This was one of those nights. A rainy day had led to a restless evening. The boy had woken up at 11 p.m. and stayed awake until 1 a.m., wanting to play and be entertained the whole time. Then it took the woman, who was so tired she couldn't fall back to sleep right away, another hour to drift off. Now it was 4 a.m., and he was up again. The woman rolled over when she heard him. She thought about nudging her husband awake and saying, "Your turn." But he was sleeping soundly, and she wasn't, so off to the baby's room she went. She would just feed him quickly and put him back down. Or so she thought. The baby was having none of it. He wanted more playtime. Thus began the battle of wills, a battle she wasn't going to win. The more the woman tried to settle him and get him to sleep, the more revved up he became. Somewhere in the middle of this, as the woman's frustration mounted, the man came into the nursery. "Hey, what's going on?" he asked stupidly. "What does it look like?" she snapped, holding up a very wide-eyed baby for him to see.
"Okay, okay. Why don't you go back to sleep and I'll take over," he said,
trying to take the child from her. "No," she said, turning so he couldn't get the baby. "I'm fine. Just go to bed."
"You're not fine. You're exhausted. It's all right. Let me take him."
"I told you I'm fine," she yelled. That set the baby to wailing. The woman looked down at what she'd done. Then she started crying, too. The man stepped in, gently wresting the baby from her, then giving his sleep-deprived wife a hug.
"Shh, it's going to be okay."
His comforting words came out in a whisper. Chapter 54. The night passed slowly. Despite my best effort to tire my body, my mind was still a boiling pot of anxiety. It made sleep nearly impossible. The drug trial was really just the first legal hurdle I had to clear, with a murder trial still to come, and a social services case peppered in between. But the fact was, if I couldn't get over that first one, the rest of it became moot. Losing the drug case meant losing Alex. Whoever had taken him would have effectively won. At that point, what did anything else matter? What did I really have to live for? They might as well execute me. Maybe that sounds bleak, but at 2 o'clock in the morning, when you're in administrative segregation, when your milk is failing and the whole world thinks you're guilty, optimism is in pretty short supply. I had just barely nodded off when the overhead light came on. 6 o'clock had arrived. I was up immediately, like a firecracker had gone off in my cell, my heartbeat already reverberating against my sternum. I went to the door and waited for a guard to pass by, which they were required to do every so often.
"Hey, you guys know I have my trial today, right?" I asked.
"We know, Beric," the guy said. "We'll come get you later."
I was too nervous to eat breakfast, which was pretty grim anyway. Not long after the tray was cleared away, two corrections officers came and got me, eventually handing me off to two sheriff's deputies, who drove me to the courthouse. When I reached the holding cell behind the courtroom, I was surprised to find a dress hanging for me from the bunk. Courtesy of Mr. Honeywell, I assumed. It was my Kate Middleton dress, which he obviously liked. The heels I always wore with it were attached in a plastic bag. I wondered how he had gotten into my house to retrieve it. Pinned to the hanger was an envelope with my name on it. Inside, I found a copy of an old picture. It showed a dashing young couple, a man and a woman who were clearly in love. From their hair and clothes, to say nothing of how faded the colors were, I'd say it was about 1975 when the photo was snapped. I could practically hear the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever playing in the background. Then I did a double take. The striking young man in the photo was Mr. Honeywell. A much younger, much slimmer, much less stooped, much more hirsute Mr. Honeywell. He was wearing a wide-collar shirt and a plaid suit that looked positively debonair on him. His eyes weren't buggy or baggy. They were, if anything, striking. He was handsome. And more than that, he was happy. And I could immediately see why. It was all about how the woman looked at him. She adored him. You could tell immediately. Any man who had a woman look at him like that, even once, could surely not have turned out like Mr. Honeywell. Was she a girlfriend or... No, a wife. They both had wedding bands on. Then I looked more carefully at her. Dark hair, cut almost exactly like mine. Dark eyes, set sort of like mine. Slender build, just like me. She was wearing a belted dress that was the 40 years ago version of the one hanging in front of me. She looked like she could be my sister or my mother. I knew she wasn't, of course. But the resemblance was uncanny enough that I held the photo and stared at her for a while longer. Then Mr. Honeywell's voice came from the far end of the holding area.
"Darn near knocked the wind out of me the first time I saw you," he said. "Felt like I was seeing a ghost."
He had been sitting quietly on a bench, watching me study his past. "So she was... This is your wife?" I said, holding up the picture.
"Her name was Barbara."
"If you don't mind my asking, what happened?" He took a moment.
"Bad luck, I guess you could say. Bad luck and bad driving. We had been married about a year. She was pregnant. Pretty far along, too. We were happy as could be, just a couple kids launching their lives together. We were out for a drive in the country one night. Not going anywhere, just driving. I had a Pontiac GTO, a real muscle car. I was taking the turns pretty tight, gunning the engine. She was just laughing. She had a great laugh. Barbara did. Clear as a bell."
He reflected on that for a beat, then continued.
"We went around this one corner, and there was a farmer on a tractor, right in the middle of the damn road, going about 5 miles an hour, no lights on, nothing. What the hell was he doing out there after dark? I have no idea. I jerked the wheel to avoid hitting him and lost control of the car. We broadsided a tree. Passenger side. We weren't wearing seat belts. No one really did back then."
He stopped. "Is that where you got your limp?" I asked.
He nodded.
Busted up my insides a lot worse than it busted up my outsides.
And Barbara? I asked. He just shook his head. You never remarried?
Never even dated again. Spent too many years either hating myself or feeling sorry for myself to be much good to anyone.
He rose from the bench and walked over to my cell, those sad, protuberant eyes locked on mine.
I let her down, he said. I'm not going to let you down.
I nodded solemnly. Thank you, I said.
Okay, then,
he said.
Get dressed. I'll see you in there.
Once he was gone, I set down the photo and changed into my dress. The belt cinched two holes tighter than the last time I had worn it. Maybe 10 or 15 minutes later, a sheriff's deputy came to retrieve me. He shackled my ankles, though not my wrists, then led me down the hallway toward a door labeled Courtroom Number 2. The walking was difficult, between my two short strides and my heels, and it took all my concentration not to trip. As such, I was still looking mostly downward as I entered the courtroom. In my peripheral vision, I could see Mr. Honeywell's rounded form at the defense table. It wasn't until I reached the table and was able to steady myself a little that I was able to lift my head. The first thing my eyes fell on was the prosecution table. Amy Kay was on the far side of it, sitting ramrod straight. A man I didn't recognize was talking to her, though I couldn't hear what he was saying. There was something about him that filled me with an immediate and visceral dislike for him. It must have been the bow tie. I moved on, scanning the gallery. Sitting in back were a man and a woman who looked bored and clutched notepads. Reporters, obviously. A little farther up, sitting in the third row, was Teddy, with Wendy faithfully by his side. My parents were in the second row. I was still shocked by how old they looked. My mother smiled nervously at me. My father lowered his head, then brought it back up. I brought my hand up to wave at them, almost despite myself. But I didn't have time to consider their presence for very long. The deputy who had brought me in gently grabbed my elbow.
Ma'am, he said, judge is about to come in. It's best if you're facing forward.
That finally unrooted me. I shuffled into place next to Mr. Honeywell. I looked toward the judge's desk. It was still empty, but it towered over all other furniture, leaving little doubt about who was the most important person in the room. All my focus, every bit of karma I might have ever accrued in this life, was now aimed at that desk and the man who would soon be sitting in it. Commonwealth versus Barrick. A one-day trial that would determine the trajectory of the remainder of my life was about to be underway. Chapter 55. Amy Kay had been studying Erin Dansby in her peripheral vision and didn't like what she was seeing. His hands shook as he shuffled papers and files around on the table in front of him. He maniacally sipped from his water glass, a sure sign of a dry mouth. He kept tapping his foot, and Erin Dansby wasn't a foot tapper. He also kept craning his neck toward the back of the courtroom, sneaking glances at the gallery. He seemed okay, if barely, when his only audience was Melanie Barrick's friends and family. Then a man and a woman entered the room. The man was a reporter from the News Leader, whom Amy knew well.
She didn't know the woman, but she also appeared to be a journalist of some sort, perhaps from the Daily Progress out of Charlottesville, or the Times-Dispatch in Richmond, or who knew, maybe the Washington Post? Whatever the case, it was apparently too much for Dansby. As soon as the reporters were settled in their seats, he turned toward Amy.
"You know what?" he said. "I think I'm going to let you handle this."
"What are you talking about?" Amy said.
"The trial. You're more ready for it than I am anyway. And I just think, well, it'll be better if you do it. Is that okay?"
Yeah, fine," Amy said. More than fine, actually. Her only real worry about this trial, the only way the Commonwealth could have snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, was if Dansby screwed up something. Melanie Barrick's last best chance for an acquittal had just recused himself from the case.
"Great," Dansby said. "I'm going to go back and tell the press that I'll be available for comment afterward, but I'm letting my deputy handle the proceeding. It's good for them to see me able to delegate important matters. It shows leadership."
Amy was bemused but didn't show it. "Leadership?" she wanted to say. "You're chickening out 3 minutes before a trial begins and you're calling that leadership?" But she just said, "Okay. Sounds like a plan." He rose and went toward the back of the courtroom and briefly spoke to the reporters. Then he took a seat by himself, two rows in front of them. Amy quietly added this to the list of stories she'd tell in private someday when Aaron Dansby was in the U.S. Senate. Then her focus shifted back to the front of the room. A deputy was entering. Judge Henry Robbins was behind him.
"All rise," the deputy said, then called the proceeding to order, finishing by asking God to save the Commonwealth and this honorable courtroom.
"Good morning, everyone," Robin said. "Have a seat, please. Do we have any last-minute issues we need to take care of before we get going?"
"No, Your Honor," Amy said. Honeywell just shook his head. The judge nodded toward Amy.
"Okay, then. Is the Commonwealth ready to open?"
"Yes, Your Honor," Amy said, buttoning her jacket as she stood up. She had not planned on giving this opening, but she was prepared all the same. She had written it, word for word, for Dansby to deliver, and she had gone over it with him enough times that she could do it without notes.
487 grams, Your Honor," she said. "It's an incredible amount of cocaine. In a relatively small county like ours, it's practically an epidemic all by itself. 487 grams is, well, it's enough to destroy families. It's enough to cause crime to rise. It's enough to stoke the fires of domestic violence. It's enough to seep into every crevice of our sleepy little valley, to flow from the hardcore addicts all the way down to the high school student who just might be curious to know what cocaine tastes like. And I think we both know how disastrous that first taste can be in a young person's life."
She bowed her head, taking a moment of silence for that unknown teenager whose life was now hurtling out of control. Then she looked back up.
"Yet 487 grams is exactly how much cocaine the Augusta County Sheriff's Office found hidden in the defendant's house, tucked in the air conditioning duct just above her child's crib. Now, we don't know exactly how much cocaine the defendant might have had before the sheriff's office came and raided her house. Did she start with 600 grams? 800? A whole kilo? There's no telling. But we do know what she had been doing with it, and what she planned to do with the rest of that 487 grams. She was going to sell it, Your Honor. According to the statute, we don't even need to prove that to you. But the evidence is still very clear on this point. We found all the paraphernalia needed for distribution, scales and razors and plastic bags. We found a list of phone numbers that correspond to known drug users. But that's not all, Your Honor, Amy continued. You're surely going to hear the defendant testify that this cocaine we found in her house wasn't hers, even though it was above where her child slept, in a place where no mother would let any stranger go. She's going to ask you to believe the fiction that this cocaine belonged to someone else, that she had no idea how it just happened to arrive in that place. But when she testifies to that, the thing I'd like you to remember is that we also found her personal cell phone, complete with pictures of herself, her husband, and her child, alongside the drug paraphernalia. Amy paused to let the judge absorb this critical piece of information. So that's dominion and control right there. The defense will surely try to confuse things, Your Honor. As you are perhaps aware, Mr. Honeywell has subpoenaed a convicted drug dealer to testify about who knows what. You're also going to hear from a neighbor, maybe some other folks, who will likely tell you they have no personal knowledge of Ms. Barrick selling drugs. But none of that is going to matter. What matters is 487 grams of cocaine found in the defendant's house. Drug paraphernalia found in the defendant's house. The defendant's cell phone found with the drug paraphernalia. It's as clear-cut a case of possession with intent to distribute as you'll ever see. Thank you. She sat down, pleased with her delivery.
Thank you, Miss Kay, the judge said, then turned back to the defense table. Mr. Honeywell, would you like to open now?
Honeywell barely bothered standing.
I'll open after the Commonwealth has put on its case.
Which is your right. Very well. Miss Kay, would you like to call your first witness?
Amy nodded at the bailiff, who was already on his way to the back of the courtroom to fetch Peter Kemp. Amy had kept an eye on the detective, and all his colleagues, really, throughout the past week. He had done nothing to further raise her suspicion. Kemp entered the courtroom wearing a nice but not too nice suit and a sloppily knotted tie. He nodded as he passed by the judge, took an oath, then settled into the witness stand. With the sheet of questions she had written out for Dansby as a guide, Amy put the witness through his paces, starting with Kemp's credentials and moving from there. Kemp testified about how he was approached by one of his regular informants, who then made a small buy for the sheriff's office. That led to the warrant, which led to the raid, which led to the evidence. Amy then guided the detective through how the cell phone they discovered did not have a password, enabling the deputies to quickly ascertain it belonged to the defendant, how the state lab certified that the powder they found was, in fact, cocaine, a Schedule II drug, how the phone numbers they found matched known offenders, and so on. Kemp was brick wall solid, as Amy knew he would be. This was the government at its best. Two seasoned professionals staying on script, presenting their evidence in a nice rhythm. No surprises. Then Amy announced she was done with Kemp, and Judge Robbins invited Honeywell to cross-examine the witness. The script was now at its end. Honeywell was standing up, getting ready to remove some bricks from the wall they had built. This, Amy knew from long experience, was where the trial really began. Honeywell started slowly, taking his little shots where he could. Did Kemp ever see Ms. Barrick handle the drugs? No. Did he see Ms. Barrick make a sale? No. Did he ever investigate whether someone might have stolen Ms. Barrick's cell phone and placed it with the drug paraphernalia? No. It was all harmless to the prosecution, and Kemp was a seasoned master of the one-word answer. Then Honeywell launched on a new angle of attack.
Now, the names and numbers you found in the box,
he said.
You said you had seen those before?
Yes, Kemp said.
Well?
As I said, they were known to us as drug users, Kemp said.
Yes, but where specifically had you seen them before?
Honeywell asked. Amy recognized a line of questioning that would lead straight to Mookie Myers. This was the door that had to stay closed. She leapt to her feet.
Objection, she said. It's outside the scope of his original testimony.
Your Honor, Detective Kemp has said twice now they're known drug users,
Honeywell said.
We have a right to explore how it is he knows that.
I agree. Objection overruled, Robin said. Continue, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor. So again, Detective Kemp, was there a recent case where you saw those same names and phone numbers?
Yes.
And what was that case?
Kemp bent toward the microphone and said the words Amy had been hoping to prevent.
The Mookie Myers case.
Thank you, Detective. And in case the court isn't familiar with that case, can you please enlighten it? Who is Mookie Myers?
He was a drug dealer who was convicted of possession with intent to distribute and is now incarcerated.
And what drug was Mr. Myers convicted of possessing and distributing?
Cocaine, Kemp said.
As you know, and as I'm sure the court knows, drug dealers often will brand their product, using a stamp to give it a kind of identity. What was the name of the brand Mr. Myers sold?
It was called Dragon King.
Thank you. And can you tell me, do you know where Mr. Myers's cocaine is at the moment?
Amy felt a sinking in her stomach even as she bolted to her feet. How did Honeywell know about that? But, of course, she could already guess. Sheriff Powers had questioned a number of deputies about the missing drugs. Nothing like that stays quiet very long. Honeywell had lived here his whole life and knew just about everyone. Eventually, the talk was bound to reach his ears. So this was the defense's plan. Embarrass the hell out of the Augusta County Sheriff's Office, confuse the issue, and hope it would lead to an acquittal. Amy had to begin damage control immediately.
Objection, she said. These are two separate cases. There is no relevance here whatsoever. It doesn't matter whether the drugs found in Ms. Barrick's house once belonged to Mookie Myers or to the Easter Bunny. All that matters is that she possessed them.
On the contrary, Your Honor, this is very relevant, Honeywell said. This goes to the heart of this case and to the heart of our defense, which is to question how it was possible a woman with no criminal record and no history of drug use could have possibly come into possession of this amount of cocaine. As you know, we have broad latitude to explore alternate theories of this crime, and we will be bringing witnesses who will do just that. That includes Mr. Myers, who has been subpoenaed and is in this courthouse, waiting to testify.
Sorry, Miss Kay, Robin said. He's right. I have to allow this.
Objection overruled. Go on, Mr. Honeywell.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I was saying, Mr. Kemp, do you know where the cocaine from the Mookie Myers case is at this moment?
Kemp shot a glance over at the prosecution table, but there was nothing more Amy could do for him. He was trapped. To say the truth was to jeopardize this case and bring humiliation to his department. To say otherwise was to perjure himself. Finally, he said,
"No." "Did you destroy it?"
Honeywell asked.
"No." "Is it in the evidence locker?"
No.
So where is it?
Honeywell pressed. I don't know, Kemp admitted.
Is it in the possession of the Augusta County Sheriff's Office?
I don't know.
You don't know,
Honeywell said, really twisting the knife.
Is it the normal policy of the Augusta County Sheriff's Office to let cocaine go unaccounted for?
No.
Did you perform an investigation when you discovered it missing?
Yes.
And what did you find?
Kemp screwed up his face as he searched for the shortest answer possible. He finally came up with,
"We were unable to reach a conclusion." So that cocaine could be anywhere, right?
I guess so.
It could even have been planted in my client's house, yes?
Objection, Amy said. The word planted is very charged in a drug case, and there's no foundation for it here.
I'll restate the question, Honeywell said. Is it possible that the cocaine from the Myers case is the same cocaine that was found in Ms. Barrick's house?
I don't know.
Well, come on now. You said you have no idea where the Myers cocaine is and that it could be anywhere. Could it, in fact, have found its way into Ms. Barrick's house?
Yes, I suppose so, Kemp said.
Could, in fact, someone in law enforcement, maybe even one of the officers who helped you execute the warrant on my client, have been the person who took it out of the evidence lockup?
Objection. Calls for speculation, Amy said.
All I'm asking is if it's a possibility, Honeywell said. That's not speculation. That's just connecting the dots.
Objection overruled, Robin said. Answer the question.
I don't know, Kemp said. But again, if you don't know where that cocaine is or who took it, you have to admit that's a possibility.
Kemp, looking utterly miserable, said,
Yes.
Thank you, Detective, Honeywell said.
Nothing further.
Ms. Kay, the judge said, would you like to redirect? Desperately. Yes, Your Honor, Amy said, standing and facing Kemp, who was now sitting in a slumped position. Detective Kemp, is there any evidence whatsoever that the cocaine missing from the lockup is the same cocaine you found in Melanie Barrick's house?
No, ma'am, he said, his back getting straighter.
In fact, new cocaine flows into this country all the time, from all over the world. Is that right?
Yes.
So if cocaine goes missing from one place in Augusta County and shows up in another place in Augusta County, that's little more than a coincidence, yes?
That's right.
And no matter where this cocaine originated, you still found it in the defendant's house, correct?
Yes.
Which was what counted as far as the statute was concerned. So yes, a door that Amy had wanted to stay closed had been flung open, and it would undoubtedly result in some unfortunate headlines for the Augusta County Sheriff's Office, thanks to two astute scribes in the back of the room. But as she rested the Commonwealth's case, she remained convinced it would only matter so much. The law, the evidence, and, most important, the judge were still on their side. Chapter 56. Had I never seen that picture of Mr. Honeywell, the young, dashing Mr. Honeywell, I might not have recognized it. But there was something about watching him flay that sheriff's detective that was almost like seeing the years peel off him.
He had an energy to him, a vitality that managed to come